Hey, good afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat. And today we are recording episode 96 and coming to you on January 20th from Toronto, Ontario, where currently the temperature with the wind factor, it's minus 20 degrees Celsius. And everything is white outside. Today, I wouldn't dare coming out of the house. It's so cold, it will freeze everything. So today is an exciting episode. I'm happy to be recording today's episode with my good friend, David Hirschfeld, and David is coming to us, I guess, from Vista, California, which I'm hoping that you're not affected by all what's going on with the fires and everything in California. We're praying for you guys, and we're sending some support from Canada here. So I hope everything is fine, and I hope they put all that stuff down. Before we get into it, David, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about yourself, introduce your audience to who you are, and I'm happy to be meeting you today. First time face-to-face, and we're recording it at the same time. Here we go.
All right. Thanks, Robin, and thanks for having me on the show. And I don't want to tell you what the weather's like here, because think of Vista as part of San Diego County. So it's San Diego, California, basically, the weather that we have. And thank you for asking about the fire. My son and granddaughter, who lived fairly close to the fire, came down and spent the last week with us while the air quality was so bad. They're home and their area is safe, but they're, you know, they were 4 or 5 miles from the fire when it was at its closest point to them. And it's a tragedy. And thank you, Canada, for all the help that you've provided for Los Angeles. There's never enough of it when there's a tragedy and a disaster at this level. So my background, I've been in the software industry for over 35 years, started out in enterprise and started my own logistics inventory route distribution, a software company. And despite every effort on my part, it ended up growing anyway to 800 customers in 22 countries and sold it in 2000 to a publicly traded firm. So that was my first experience with a startup after having been in enterprise for several years. Then I was VP of products for the acquiring company for the next several years until I left, and then eventually started Techies, my current company, in 2007. So that was almost 18 years ago when I started Techies. And we do custom software development for startups and scale-ups and all types of companies in a lot of different industries, healthcare, finance. And I've worked with a lot of startups over those 17 years as well. And now almost everything I do is focused around AI.
Well, great. Well, nice to meet you. And for our audience, you know, on this channel, we talk a lot about AI. We talk a lot about the impact of AI and the technology in general, not just on the language business, but on any industry to be, not to be specific, to be in general. And today's conversation, it's very timely because of all the changes that's happening in our industry, all of the buzz that we hear about new application coming up, new software coming up, new startups coming up in our industry, trying to take advantage of what's going on with the technology challenges, solving problems, using technology, using AI, et cetera. And David's company, which intrigued me for this conversation, could be a help for some of the entrepreneurs out there that they're looking up to put a software together to solve a problem, to start a company, or to perhaps develop something internally. And I can't wait to dig into it deeper here with David and try to understand how does this actually work. But there is a huge demand because we all have a strain of an entrepreneurship in us as individuals, even though we're employees by companies. As David mentioned, he started his career on the enterprise side and ended up being an entrepreneur on his side. So everybody had that thought in their mind, right? What if I created a software, or if I created an app, or if I created something to solve a problem, but I don't know where to start from. I don't know how to begin. I don't know. I don't have a software expertise. Some people don't have software expertise. They got an idea. David, why don't we solve all this problem here by you telling us how Techies work and what brought Techies to the birth, if you will, to fruition when you first started? Why Techies? Why did you come up with that?
So I had another startup just before Techies that was in the automotive industry, and that one failed. Anybody who hasn't had a failed startup is either the one in a million or hasn't really tried to start anything. So, and I say that a little bit tongue in cheek. Some people have a very specific type of business that they're trying to pursue, and they know the industry well, or they get involved in an industry that they don't know, but it sounds interesting to them. And then they just muck and grind for years and years and eke out a living. And there are a lot of those. I'm talking much more about the software startups that are looking to grow something into a significant size company, not necessarily a unicorn. And I can talk a lot about the mindset of a startup founder and the philosophies behind startups, because I've worked with close to 90 startups in the last 17 years, not counting my own startups. And the reason why my startup fail is the same reason that I watch so many others fail. And I waited way too long to try to generate revenue from it. I actually had customers that were signing up for it. Then I figured I needed to raise money to then be able to accelerate and fund it. They were all on a free version of the software. And I had fear around, this was almost 20 years ago. This was my second software startup. I had a fear around starting to charge for it. It was a business-to-business network for auto wholesalers and dealers, basically trading cars between each other and being able to source cars. It was a product that was needed. It was needed for a decade afterwards, but I ran out of money and resources to be able to continue to pursue that business, which is when I started Techies. And I started Techies as a custom software shop because I know how to build software for myself as well as for other people. And it was easy to find business to get started. It took me a long time to build a really competent business where, you know, our focus is on really exceptionalism in terms of how our team operates, how we work with customers. And I have all kinds of evidence what exceptional teams do, but it wasn't difficult for me to start that company and find business to begin with from a startup perspective, because I knew the industry, I knew how to deliver, you know, I had all the basics already, which brings me to answer the question you had, which is, how does somebody that doesn't really know how to go about this start? So, and let's just, I'm talking software primarily since that's my world, but let's say you work in an industry where you struggle with a problem in your industry on a regular basis. And that's important. It's got to be like on a weekly basis or daily basis. If it's a yearly basis, that's very difficult to stay top of mind with your prospective customers. And it's, you have to have a huge value proposition for businesses like that to find a foothold in the market. So it's got to be a problem you're struggling with on a daily or weekly basis, or at least on a weekly basis. And it has to be a big enough problem where you can say why it personally impacts you from a perception perspective, and also separately how much it impacts you financially from a cost perspective. And those are independent numbers. Mm-hmm. Because you can have some problems that have a huge financial impact for one person in an industry, but it's an industry where everybody deals with that same problem and it's endemic in the industry, and you go, yeah, but we all do. It's the problem we're all struggling with, we always have, you know, and so the personal impact is almost nothing. And your ability to get somebody's attention because you talk to them about that problem is very low. So, and it's very difficult to sell a product when it's difficult to get somebody's attention about the problems they're struggling with. So it has to be a high impact problem from a perception perspective and a high cost problem. And if you're that person and you struggle with that type of problem, you can articulate those things and you have reach in your industry to other people that are doing the same kind of thing you're doing that are struggling with the exact same problem you're struggling with. That is a foundation for a potentially successful startup, because getting to the point where you have product market fit is such a shorter straight line than if you just have what you think is a cool idea for the next Facebook or the next Instagram or something like that, then your risk factor goes up through the roof.
Of course. Now, when we talk about the idea itself that somebody comes up with, what's the difference in your opinion between creating a unique or coming up with a unique idea to solve a, as you mentioned, and I love your definition, you know, your problem, the problem that you define as a problem, it has to be bigger than just a singular problem. It has to be, you know, a broad problem, and not necessarily people have learned to live with the problem, and you're trying to get them off the wagon, so to speak, because it would be harder to do that. Commercialization of the product becomes a little bit of a difficulty for you. So once you've defined a problem, that unique problem, and you created a unique solution for it, is it necessarily to have an entire software created, or can it be a feature in a software? Where do you draw the line, or how do you advise on that?
Okay, so excuse me. If it's, first of all, it can be a very discrete problem. If the value is high and the impact is high, then that is the best kind of problem to solve, because you're solving for one thing and your audience has a magnetic affinity to needing a solution for that problem. That's like the best. Those are hard to find, but they do happen often. When new technologies come along, like AI, all of a sudden, ability to solve problems you didn't think really could be solved before, because you've been assumed you'd always have to live with these problems, and now all of a sudden there's ways to solve them. Now there's lots of discrete problems that you can solve implementing some AI solution to do it, because AI can do things that you couldn't do before without a tremendous cost and effort. So having something discrete is important. Focusing on just one or two problems is really important. And when I say problems, I don't mean at a high level, but I mean at a very root level, because as a founder, you have one job, and all founders have this one job to start with. Nobody ever tells founders this, and they don't realize it, but it's the number one job they have at the very beginning. And that's, out of all the niche, you've got this thing you want to solve, right? This problem. And out of all the niches that you can market to, and all of the root level problem statements that you can derive from that one problem, and I can explain in another podcast interview what a root problem statement is, because that's a whole thing. You have to figure out which of all those niches, only one niche, that has the highest perceived impact and the highest cost, those two things combined, for the one or two of those root problem statements that they're struggling with out of all the other niches. And that is your number one job, because once you've got that, then you know, then building that initial MVP product becomes much simpler. You know how to speak to that niche about the problem, because you know exactly what the problem is, and you know what's going to get them to lean forward and go, I hate that, can you make it stop? You know how much to charge, because you know what it costs them. And you can do what we call launch first approach, and go out to that client with maybe some click-through mockups or more sophisticated kind of what I call a high fidelity prototype that looks like a real software product but isn't, and go out and do pre-launch sales. And you can do that if you offer them a high enough value in terms of what they're going to get if they buy in now versus waiting until the product's on the market. And if the problem's big enough and it costs them enough and the value is high enough, they will buy in enough numbers even before you start building your product that you can prove you've got product market fit. And that is what you have to do.
And correct me if I'm wrong, is this an answer to commercialization and cash flow generation between starting an idea and how fast can I get money in the bank from this idea? Because if you don't, then you're risking failure by running out of money on the development side, right?
Right. So a lot of software companies think they have to create an MVP and a pitch deck and then find investors, right? This is the pattern that VCs have been foisting on us for decades now. And they want that because they want as many pitch decks coming to them as possible, right? And the typical, and I'm not making this up, I've verified this with, I've read articles about this, I've talked to VCs and they've confirmed it. 3,000 pitch decks will result in 30 companies that are invested in, of which 3 to 5 of them will find a path to profitability. The others fail. This is VC funded companies, right? So your chance of getting VC funding is so small. And it's just, and everybody says, okay, I can't get VCs yet, so I'm going to go after, get angels. It's pretty small for getting angels as well. If you've got friends and family that believe in you and want to invest in you, that's the best way to get started. But even better than that is go out and get your customers to invest in you by doing these pre-launch sales, because you can generate as much money as you would from seed investment. You can generate as much money from pre-launch sales. And everything you do to get ready for a pre-launch sale is something you would have to do anyway to move your business forward. Nothing you do when you're trying to raise money from a VC actually moves your business forward.
That's right. Now, how important, in your opinion, is for the idea of a product or a software to be, everybody wants to be like the only software in the world that can solve this particular problem. But I'm just taking our industry as an example. You know, I want to say when I first entered the industry 20 years ago, there was like maybe one software for the industry. It's called Trados at the time, made by a company called SDL. Now there's like 20 of them, maybe 20. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Everybody makes their own TM, they call it transaction management software. And everybody now have their own. There are like the top, you know, it's like long list of TMSs out there. And the industry hasn't like, the number of words translated in the industry is growing, but still around, you know, $60 billion industry. It's not that big of an industry globally. Mm-hmm. But how, you know, just asking as a general question, taking what I know about our industry, how important is either A, being unique, or creating another product or services that says, yeah, I'm like the other guy, but I've got a couple of features that are different?
Yeah, and you would probably do that because you're somebody that works in the industry and you recognize that this company is not doing it very well, or they're missing opportunity, or they're charging too much, and they're only focused on enterprise, but all these small SMBs need the same service, or whatever that is, right? Mm-hmm. Or you have a way of marketing it through partners and channels that is completely different. And so therefore, that's totally viable. A totally viable way. If you don't want to basically produce a product where you've got a dominant competitor that's inexpensive, that has a great system, you probably don't want to necessarily go after that unless the market's so big that you can get a foothold in that market early on. And one example of that could be playbooks. I'll just give you an example. There is a great market for playbook software. Playbooks are the idea that you figure out a process within your business, and now you document that in what you call a playbook so that you can scale. That way, when somebody new comes in, instead of completely relying on staff to train them, even if you do, they have something they can refer to that has all of the scenarios and nuances for that job, right? Or for that workflow in the form of a playbook, all right? And there are some companies out there, one that's really very doing really well, is called Trainuel. But that is a wide open market because there aren't really consumable products out there that make it really easy to document and capture playbooks and be able to then surface that playbook in the context of some process in your own company, right?
Yep.
So that's an example. Coming up with your own version of something, or I'll give you one which I'm working on right now, which surprised me, and that's Referral Partner Portal. So there's all kinds of partner management software out there, but they're primarily focused on channel partners and big enterprise, and there's just not much, and or on trying to build a partner network where they make money off of surfacing referral partners for you, but not making it simple to just add a referral partner, manage what the contractual relationship is, and track the revenue as it accrues. The partner can log in and get their own, right? This is something we're just building right now for ourselves, that it turns out everybody we're talking to wants it as well. So I wasn't even thinking of creating a SaaS company out of that. I was just building it for, we do a lot of internal software development for improving our automation, like for example, our estimation process, another one that will probably turn into a SaaS process. But it's solving problems that are really close to you that make it much easier for you to take that and then elaborate. And the reason we did that is I couldn't find a referral partner portal software out there that was simple, consumable, and expensive that I could just start using and adding my referral partners to.
Well, absolutely. So basically, you're, from a logical point of view, from a business point of view, in developing these ideas, you're fine with the idea that says, you know, I'm taking something that exists in the market already, and I'm adding a couple of features to solve another problem that the main software provider, probably, if you want to call them that, was not able to, or did not address it properly.
Or simplifying. like in my case, this is just a really simplified referral partner portal that isn't meant to manage complex channel partner relationships, right? Which is what all the other ones are out there doing. Right, a simple, something consumable for a different market that may do the same, some of the same things, but just is focused on something much more simple, right? In terms of its problem statement that it's solving.
David, tell us a little bit about Techies, your company. What is it located? How many employees you have? What do you focus on?
Okay, so Techies, we're what you would call probably a boutique software development shop. We range 30 to 40 people. About half of those people are full-time on my team, and the other half we bring in as we're scaling up or down on projects. The thing about, look, I'm located in San Diego, but our entire team is remote in many different countries, both from a cost management perspective and also from a ability to recruit really good talent. One thing, and I've made many, many trips overseas building my teams. This is not like I throw it over to some team that's offshore and hope for the best. And our clients, especially what I call recovery projects, where they've been working with other software development companies, when they are referred to us because they've been struggling for a year, two or three, they immediately recognize the difference. Those are some of my favorite projects because they're just love working with us. Anyway, I'm in San Diego. And like I said, my team is spread all over the place. But if you're interested in talking to us, ask me for what the evidence that we have, what it means to be exceptional, not just a competent team, but really exceptional. And I'll show you, because you shouldn't take my word for it or anybody else's word.
Yeah, yeah.
You should see the evidence. Yeah.
Absolutely. You seem to be passionate about it, David, which, you know, that's a good indication of somebody that believes in the product. You have to drink your own Kool-Aid sometimes in this world, and you seem to have done that very well.
Yeah, thank you very much. Plus, we're constantly automating everything internally, and we never feel like we're good enough. So we're always pushing the edge and improving on us internally, much more than other companies, which, again, I can show you what I mean, and I think you'll agree.
Hey, David, speaking of that, the improvement side on a tech side, where do you, you know, with this whole world is going bananas, I hear reports from CES in Vegas, is everything was about AI in that conference. That's the, for those, for the audience, that's the Consumer Electronics Show that takes place in Vegas on early January every year. I hear this year has been all about AI, robotic this and technology that, and et cetera. So the traditional form of software development, you know, your coding, et cetera. How does AI play a role in what you do? And are you involved in development of AI application? I don't know if we can still call them application. They're calling them agent now. I don't know. I don't know if you're involved in it. What's your take on that?
Yeah, we've been dealing with what are called agentic workflows, where you actually have multiple agents communicating with AI agents, and they communicate with each other based on their specialty. For example, in software development, you might have an AI agent that's a project manager, and one that's a developer, one that's a database architect, one that's a QA tester. And each of these agents are communicating with each other throughout the development lifecycle of a function, a module, an entire application. So we've been involved in this agentic workflow and building agentic workflows for about 9 months now, when agentic workflows are much newer and earlier, longer than that, actually. We're automating everything internally using AI and using that to automate code generation as well, to the degree that we can do that in a competent, responsible way. And what I mean by that is, if we just leave it to AI to try to build the systems, it just isn't quite there yet. I believe with this new release with OpenAI that's coming out in early February, O3, full version of O3, it may be there to be able to really competently assemble systems together using agentic workflows to a certain degree. I think we're still another year away, at least, from being able to really build competently full systems in a way where we have feedback and management of the process and the requirements and the whole thing. We're building internal tools with AI, our estimation process is pristine and accurate and incredibly detailed in how we do it, but it's also really expensive. We do it for every project that we do, very often on our own dime when we're doing an estimate for a client, but That's one of the things that helps us win projects, because our estimates are so much more detailed and broken down and module based than our competitors. So we are building an AI model to mimic how we do our estimation process. We're building one for launch first that does all the niche analysis for us, the niche analysis problem statements and the metrics system of the methodology. I'm using AI to build the referral partner portal, but it's, so we're using it everywhere we can. And we have weekly meetings, an AI roundup, weekly meetings with the whole team. Talk about how did you use AI last week in a new way? Where's a place you think you might be able to push it in a new way this week? Where is it in our workflow? On and on. So AI is literally everything, because it's so hard to predict where we're going to be in a year from now. So I feel like, as a development team, instead of getting to ride the, 3-foot waves or 5-foot waves, or that, I live in San Diego, so I have to use a surfing metaphor, or that 10-foot wave, we're a exceptional team, so we're in the 10-foot waves regularly. And here's this 100-foot wave that's coming. We can all see it. And so instead of sitting there just staring at it, letting it just literally wash you over like a tidal wave, we've paddled out to it. We've stood up on our board in this 10-foot wave. We're at the very tip of our board trying to stay ahead of that crest. And that's where we are. That's how
I love your analogy.
Yeah, thanks.
Obviously, you're a surfer.
Yeah, no, I am really good at falling off a surfboard. I used to do it for an entire week every Sunday before we moved to San Diego.
Well, I'll tell you my first surfing experiment with surfing in Hawaii. And it's just, I'll save that for another podcast. It's hilarious.
You'll say that you're going to save it, but really, you hope everybody forgets that, right?
I hope everybody forgets that. Question for you, when you are using AI in that capacity, as you explained earlier, from a, I'm assuming it's for productivity gain in your own development process. Am I correct? And what has been the impact on the productivity?
Quality, consistency. For everything, yeah.
And have you seen like a dramatic shift in the impact on your productivity, the quality, consistency, etc., all the measurements?
Yes.
By using AI?
We've seen shifts. It's getting right to the point where I can start to say these are dramatic shifts. But it's a lot of the time, I shouldn't say that. Yes, we have seen dramatic shifts in certain areas, my gosh, like in creating test plans and test scripts and writing and doing user story. We've seen a huge shift in some of the debugging and the generating of code. But we've seen in points, we see huge shifts in other places where we're dealing with stuff that's just very sophisticated and very difficult to articulate to AI what we want and how we want it done, because the AI is not quite there for that. Then the shift hasn't been as big, but it's a building, like I said, it's a 100-foot wave and we're on the tip of it. We're looking at building AI agents, less agentic workflow, AI agents for each step in our development lifecycle. Even like our daily stand-up meetings, which is for you software developers out there, is a term in Agile, where you have this daily stand-up where you talk about, you say, this is what I completed yesterday, this is what I'm planning on working on today, and here's dependencies I have. Everybody in each little project team does this, and it's supposed to take 15 minutes, but very often it extends to an hour and wastes a lot of people's time. And so we're automating this. We're going to have an AI agent for doing that, AI agent for updating people's JIRA tickets with what the status of it and how much time they put into it that day, the previous day, and do this on a daily basis, and so many things, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And on the journey to autonomous, I guess everybody's got that conversation going on right now from an AI perspective. We're not there, obviously. People are measuring things by percentages. Just give the audience some, where are you now in terms of percentage of involvement of a human and technology, like when it comes to AI? Do you say you are 80% human, 20% AI? Can you put a number?
That's probably right. That's probably right. 80% human, 20% AI, maybe 70-30. But I see this as a tipping point. We're getting close to the tipping point where we'll be able to, my goal is for the same size team to have a scale of 10 times as many clients, for example, and be able to service them at the same level of exceptionalism we do now or better, mm-hmm. without having to add any more people. And everybody on my team just becomes that much more expert in terms of the projects, and needs to be less the code junk, the code jockey, or the automation, the QA automation script jockey, or, you know, all of that, right?
That's right.
So
yeah. I tried something called the bolt.new, I guess, on, I was just like trying to get a refresher on what's going on in my coding ability. And I was able to create a website like in no time, and not just a simple website. It was a website, what I would consider a little bit more problematic for automation, you know, like payment right. modules and all that stuff, integration with APIs, those kinds of things. And it spits out the code perfectly. I'm sure you've heard of it, and I'm sure you've probably used tools like it. So. What's your opinion?
I used it, and when I tried to build a database application with it, it ran into some pretty significant problems. Then there's another one out there called Replit, R-E-P-L-I-T, and it was able to do that with the database applications really, you know, very competent way. But they all run into loops where they get stuck in certain spots, and then they can't get out of their thinking loop in terms of how to. And you might have the same bug in 20 iterations, and it keeps coming back with the same bug every time. And then maybe it gets past it, maybe it doesn't. And then you have to figure out how to redirect it so it starts thinking in a different way, so that it looks at a different part of the app, or consider. And that requires some technical skill to understand what it should be doing versus what it's doing, or get into the code and just fix it yourself. But yeah, I've been using Replit more recently. I haven't I use both. 2.5-3 months ago, really ran into significant problems with the database. I haven't tried it again since. That's when somebody on a podcast said, well, we had just tried Replit. It was pretty cool. Try that. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And found it to be quite good. And the code gets all synced to GitHub. So I've got a version repository for the code, and it has a very nice scaling model when you deploy it. It's a serverless kind of environment. So you only get charged for actual usage, and it's pretty inexpensive. Yeah, I'm very impressed with these tools. Yeah,
me
too. To a certain degree. If you want microservices architecture, which is what we build all of our applications with for clients, you want it to be microservices and all service-based and all message-based and all the things that you want in a modern architecture, you're not going to get there with those tools, not yet anyway.
No, just if you want to build something basic, I'm assuming.
Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe even a little bit more than basic, but yeah, it depends on the type of, you know, there's certain types of applications that are really good fit for.
Yep. David, the elephant in the room. So here comes, you know, for customers, eventually your customers, eventually, hopefully, who are located here in North America, you know, one of the big questions that they run through their mind when they hear about development company that's based in North America is the cost. And you see, so a lot of those, idea or business people who have like idea entrepreneurs, they want to create something or develop something. First thing they look into is they look offshore, and they go offshore trying to develop these ideas. Can you speak to a little bit to, you know, the advantages, disadvantages to that, and where does techies rank?
Okay. So the word offshore has a really negative connotation, because most people think of offshore as the typical India or Pakistani team. And I say typical because there are really exceptional teams in India and Pakistan. I assume I don't work in Pakistan. I did early on. I don't anymore. And so what happens is you'll always get the same quote originally. If you have a project, you go to a typical company offshore or anywhere offshore, even near shore, and they'll say, we'll have it done in 3 months and it'll cost this amount, which seems very low or reasonable. I would run from those estimates, because it'll be 18 months and you still won't have something that works, even if it was a fixed price. And sometimes they'll keep charging more for it, and sometimes you'll still be stuck in that fixed price 18 months. You're not any closer to a product. In some cases, you won't even have something yet that they've given you to test. I have seen even that. Then you have companies who are in the U.S. that are not any better than those teams, or that are really exceptional teams. And you'll get quotes that are really range a lot. So you might get a quote that's $10,000 for that project, and they'll say 3 months. You might get a quote that is $750,000 for the same project from a US-based firm. They may be a really good firm. And really, the truth is somewhere on the lower side of the middle of that. It's probably $75,000 to $150,000 if you're working with a really good team to get you to a version that people would start paying for. That is typically the case. So with us, and we take over projects from US-based firms. One of our biggest customers came from one of the largest US developers that focuses on healthcare. And that client, who we've had for about 2 years, would be probably one of our strongest references in terms of the difference. It doesn't matter where the team is. It matters how they operate. That, when you talk to anybody, ask them, how do you run your projects? What makes you exceptional? How do you do your estimates? How do you build your, how do you do your design and prototyping? Ask them these questions. How do you bill? And how does transparency work in your organization? When you ask those questions, a lot of times they won't be able to answer them all, or they'll have very poor answers or weak supporting information, but they should be able to show you incredibly detailed information for any of those questions on how they do it on a regular basis and how they track all that detail in their projects.
So in your opinion, just focus on the outcome, basically, rather than, don't get too excited about low prices.
Don't get excited. No, actually be very concerned about low prices.
In everything, I guess, nowadays, low prices are, you know, a signal that something is off here.
Yeah, but if you're off here, it is a dramatic impact, right? Because you, let's say you get a quote for 30,000 or 35,000. They say the MVP will be done in 3 months, and you're 6 months in, and you either every time you touch the thing it breaks, or you don't have anything to show for those 6 months, and they're saying it's going to be another 3 months, and then another 3 months. Just run. You need to, don't sit there wondering if this will ever get better, because it won't.
It won't.
If they were good, it would be in 3 months. If they weren't done, they'd be very close, and you would have already been testing most of the functionality, and it would work, and they would be fixing bugs that you find with, and you wouldn't be creating a whole new stream of bugs. Every time they fix one, you find three new ones that weren't there before. Just run from these companies.
Absolutely.
And if you're in the middle of that switch, you need to find a really competent company. It won't ever get better. I talk to people, I tell them that it just doesn't ever get better. It's
just
what
you're
experiencing is what you can expect to experience forever. And it might get worse.
Yeah. No, I know we're just starting the year here. It's only 20 days in, January 1st. So what's your goal for 2025? What's for 2025 hope and desire for techies and yourself personally?
So we're working on three products right now internally internally that we're going to turn into SaaS products. So I'd like to have all those products launched by probably the somewhere between Q1 and Q2 during that time period. Probably a couple of them will be launched this quarter, and then one of them may not be launched until in Q2 as SaaS products, and then we'll start to grow that. I have a very lucrative referral partner program, which is what made me start this whole thing with referral partners. And so what I'm hoping is to assign a lot of referral partners and cultivate a handful of those to be really active. Active to me is like one really qualified prospect a quarter from a referral partner. That would be a highly active one, because if they're a highly qualified prospect, 88 out of 10 of those, once we get into an evaluation process, will go forward with the project. So that's my goal. And also to automate everything in our workflow as possible, at least get to that. I think by the end of this year, we'll be at 60 to 80%, you know, AI or automation, 40%, 30 to 40% human.
Absolutely.
And so that we can expand and scale.
So you've got lofty goals for 2025. I hope you achieve all of them, right? So I hope at least you get your SaaS projects up and running and start making some money out of those.
What do you hear from other people as far as their goals go? Because you probably asked that question about goals for the year, right, with everybody. So what are some of the goals that you hear?
So some of the goals I hear is, you know, integrating AI into the process. You know, a lot of people talk about integrating AI more into the process. Now, I know AI has been talked to for 2024 and parts of the 2023 quite heavily. And people are on board. Now, you know, they went through the shock first and adoption later. And now they seem to be rolling in with it. So 2025 is going to be a year of transformation for many people in terms of the technology, the process around technology, how they do work, because technology is going to influence everything they do. So I hear a lot of people talking about the main goal being implementing AI and taking full advantage of it in their business.
Well, one thing that maybe this will resonate with some people is I call it AI chaos, because where do you implement it? How do you approach it? And it should be more about workflow automation as opposed to, right, it's transforming the workflows from manual process or from a semi-digital process with manual intervention that is tedious and slow to workflow automation. And if you look at your business from the standpoint of bottlenecks in terms of where is my business crippled for growth? You know, things flow into a certain thing and aspect of my business. And at that point, if I take on more business, that part of my business is going to probably be the reason why we are not servicing our customers properly. Yep. Then focus on that area until that channel opens up by workflow automation. And as soon as you do, then all that flow will flow into some other aspect of your business, or the upside of your business will all of a sudden not be feeding it fast enough because your capacity has grown so much. So where in that part of your business do you need to focus so that you can fill up that channel, you know, basically your workflow channel? And if you do that, then it becomes very discreet and very obvious what you need, where you want to focus that workflow automation, and then think, okay, is this just simple workflow automation, or is this something that AI will really facilitate? And very often it's a blend of both.
And you know, the second thing that people talk about a lot, and they don't talk about it, they talk about it, but they don't talk about it, is revenue for 2025. People are trying to do whatever they can to, and I'm reading in the subtext here, to increase mm-hmm. their revenue, to create, you know, which is very important for me, like to understand a little bit better about mm-hmm. maybe you don't have the time, maybe you can give us a bit of a small explanation on your partner referral program, where, sure. you know, that could be helpful as well for those who are seeking to figure out a way beyond hiring, you know, an army of salespeople, how to generate organic sales.
Right. Okay. So one way for me to basically get the word out is to do podcasting. I've got my new podcast called Scaling Smarter that we just published the first republish of episodes where I'm interviewed this past weekend. And then I'm also interviewing people, which I'd also like to invite you, Robin, to be a guest on the show. So it'll be a blend of both. And then I'm building up referral partners. So the way that works is that somebody who is involved in the software industry, whether it's in the startup industry or whether it's in existing company, with existing companies, SMBs or enterprise, and there is potential project work. We're not a body shop, so to speak, but we're really a project team. That's just how we like to operate. And we know that we can deliver in an exceptional way if we have control of the project. Then if somebody makes an introduction, says, I know a great team that can handle your project, that's all they have to do, then a part of my referral partner program is then the company has a year to sign anything with us to get going on a project. And as long as it's sometime in that 12-month period after the referral was made, because you got to cut it off at some point, right? Then that starts another clock, which is 12 months of invoicing, and you get 10% of the invoice, total invoice value on the receipt of payment. So if a client is, you know, $5,000 a month to $25,000 a month, and that would be probably our average. Some are much bigger, really nothing smaller than that typically. So 10% is what we pay on the gross invoice. So if it's $15,000 or $20,000 a month, that would be $1,500 to $2,000 a month as a referral fee for a year, 12 months of that.
So for our audience, this is very interesting, because what David just mentioned right now, if you want to be part of their referral program, I'm assuming you can reach out to you, David, right? And then
yes.
become part of the referral
yeah.
program.
And you might ask why we pay that much. And I figured that's how much it would cost us to actually generate that business through sales and marketing directly, about 10%. So of that first year's invoicing. So yeah, reach out to me directly. Techies is spelled T-E-K-Y-Z. And you can reach me at david@techies.com. Again, T-E-K-Y, and it's David at Techies. Or you can look me up, David Hirschfeld, on LinkedIn. And I'm pretty easy to find there on LinkedIn.
Yeah, and this is very interesting too, because for those who are, you know, hearing things, or, you know, the biggest thing in business right now is to develop those kinds of relationship, those kinds of connections. You know, one of the main thing that perhaps stops people from going the extra mile and referring somebody is they're asking themselves, what's in it for me? In your case, you solve that by saying there's 10% in it for you. If you want to be part of the program.
There are some people that don't want the referral fee because it creates a conflict of interest if they're a business consultant, for example. But I don't expect anybody to give me something for free. That's disingenuous. So the referral partner program eliminates that as a concern. Just tell me you want to be a referral partner. I send out, it's a mutual referral agreement. It can be customized if it works differently in your world, if I refer projects to you. And then that will, and then is anything you refer is becomes this, basically falls under this referral agreement.
Absolutely. Before we hang up now, we're coming up onto the hour here. Any last comments, any last advice you want to give the audience?
If you just feel like overwhelmed by what you're supposed to do with AI, like I said, this is AI chaos, right? Or if you've got a startup idea and you don't know what to do or where to go or how to get started with it, you know, give me a call. I could probably either of those things, you know, is AI chaos. I can help give you just a free conversation. It wouldn't cost you anything. And you don't have to worry about me trying to sell you anything. I just like talking with people and helping them. So I can probably simplify a lot of your thinking and help get you and redirect you in the right way. And the same thing with startup ideas. I'll talk with a startup founder and I'll give them a lot of suggestions or things that they can do that they'll go off and start doing those things just to decide whether this is the right way of validating whether this is a good idea and something that they pursue. They may or may not come back to me later. They usually do if they figure out that there's a project they want to pursue and they figure out how they're going to fund the initial part of it. And I can help reduce how you, your dependency on funding very often significantly to the point where you can self-fund the development through pre-launch sales and then put yourself in a much better position than if you do want to go out to investors, because now you've got this growing customer base and you've proven product market fit. And now investors are going to look at you as, this is something that I can see that there's an actual business, not just a good product idea, but a real business already happening.
It's not a PowerPoint deck, right?
It's not a deck. It's not just a deck, right?
You got some prototypes on the go. Excellent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I want to thank you, David. Thanks for joining me today. I really appreciate it. It's an honor and pleasure to have you with me and nice to meet you. Hopefully it's not your last visit to this podcast channel. Hopefully we get you back in here for another type of conversation. We'll be a little bit more focused on a specific problem that we would like to solve together. The best conversations. Yeah. And anything else you'd like to add?
No, just that I really appreciate you having me on the show. And it was a fun conversation, probably because I did most of the talking. But
I love that.
I like to talk. I actually listen really well for anybody that wants to give me a call. But in this context, I like to talk. And it's just fun. Talk to somebody with your kind of expertise and understanding. And you, of course, your questions are really good for that reason.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. And for the audience, I thank you so much for listening in today. And I hope you can join us again for the next episode, which is coming up next week. For now, this is Robin Ayoub signing off, and talk to you at the next episode. Thank you so much for listening in.
Bye, everybody.